Hi, everybody. Welcome to New Frontiers in Functional Medicine, where we are interviewing the best minds in functional medicine. And of course, today is no exception. I'm excited to be back with Dr. Anurag Singh. Let me give you his background, and we're going to jump right into what will be a very interesting conversation around GLP-1 agonists and, just really thinking about how to approach these with care and having some background understanding how we can support our patients. Okay, Dr. Singh is currently chief medical officer at Timeline, which develops next generation advanced nutritional products targeting improvements in mitochondrial and muscle health. With an MD in internal medicine and a PhD in immunology, his experience includes work for top consumer health and startup biotech companies. He's authored over 40 articles in top science journals, and he's designed and led over 50 randomized clinical trials in nutrition. His research over the past decade across multiple clinical trials on the postbiotic urolithin A and its health benefits related to muscle health has led to the launch of multiple consumer products. Dr. Singh, once again, welcome to New Frontiers.
Pleasure always. Thanks for having me, Karen.
Yes, it's always great to have you and to just kind of pick your brain on what you're thinking about. Anybody who's listened to my content knows that I am a huge fan of the compound urolithin A. I think it's an important piece of the puzzle for many of us trying to optimize wellness. And now we want to look at, GLP-1. First, let's define GLP-1 agonists, but, Many individuals are using these, probably rightly so. So what are they? I'm curious, this is a little bit of a sidebar question. I'm curious of your thoughts around long-term use. But one of the pieces that we're going to touch on is the potential for muscle loss. So what do we know about GLP-1 drugs? Do we like them? Long-term safety, muscle loss. Yeah. Okay.
Sure. Go. That's a great question to start the discussion. So GLP-1 agonists, they were initially stands for glucagon-like peptide, right? So basically, these are peptide-based drugs that are sort of binding to the GLP-1 receptor in the pancreas. That's where glucagon, which is sort of the anti-insulin hormone, right? So glucagon raises, made by sort of the alpha cells in the pancreas, raises your glucose levels, and beta cells make insulin that kind of keep your glucose levels down. And so these were developed for diabetics, right? So the primary goal in the last 10 years, and that's how long it takes to develop a drug, and their safety was documented. They were approved as drugs in some cases in obese individuals with diabetes as one of the primary line of treatments by endocrinologists, and in addition to other drugs like metformin, etc. What they found over the last 5 years in clinical studies, and perhaps also as they went into overweight, obese diabetics, was they started seeing weight loss patterns emerge. And then they ran these really long 12, 18-month interventions. So the drug is called semaglutide. It's basically the foundation of these drugs that we know as Ozempic or Wegovy. There are different names around it. So the biology is you inhibit glucagon, you kind of boost the insulin levels, your glucose metabolism is in good shape. The other thing that these drugs do is they kind of delay gastric emptying. So that also kind of is a secondary impact, and that sort of suppresses the appetite hormone and the appetite reward center in the brain. And so you get this really dual effect of lowering blood glucose sort of levels and having, weight loss.
Can I just ask you, this is not your area of focus, but just the fact that it can prompt increased insulin, then the lowering of blood sugar in diabetics. I mean, I haven't necessarily seen that in obese individuals, nor have I read about it without diabetes, like hyperinsulinemia being a phenomena and hypoglycemia being the fallout. And I'm just curious if you've come across anything on that.
No, I think what is known in the clinical trials that have come, and these are a number of studies that go by step one, step two, or sustain one to sustain others. There's a lot of well-designed randomized trials. One of the common features that have emerged is a lot of effects linked to the GI system, side effects. A lot of people have nausea as one of the most common ones. Some people have diarrhea, but nausea seems to be one of the main ones. I don't think, and if you think about it from a clinician's perspective, some of them could be linked to things like hypoglycemia, but I think people haven't really looked into it. What they have looked into it, what is the core message, I think, in the discussion for today is body composition. And so, you know, what is clear is that these are great, great drugs. These are, you know, perhaps the first $100 billion drug, millions of users. The problem is they were designed for obese individuals and diabetics, and now they're entering mainstream healthy folks who are trying to take it. And that has repercussions on just not fat loss, but muscle loss.
Well, I mean, I think across the board, whoever is taking it, it seems so they're clearly losing weight. That's a consistent feature of these drugs.
Yeah.
But muscle loss is a real occurrence with them.
So if you look at at this famous publication in New England Journal of Medicine, this famous step one trial, they looked at thousands of individuals, and then they did a body composition over time in a cohort of about 140, 150 individuals. So what they see is that you lose about 10 to 15 kilos of fat mass, but you also lose about 5 to 7 kilos of muscle mass.
Now, that's incredible.
Think about the trajectory of muscle health, which is my primary area of focus.
Yes.
After your 30s, you're losing about between 1 to 3 kilos every 10 years, right? And that gets accelerated in your 60s and 70s. Now, with this drug that's sustained long in 12 to 18 months, you're losing almost 4 to 5 times higher in a short span of a year that you're losing in 10 years in terms of muscle mass. The other problem is when you stop the drug, these are folks who, again, and that's the message we want to pass on, is that, you know, diet and exercise and boosting, keeping your nutrition is very important. And so a lot of these folks, the fat comes back because, you know, the moment you stop the drug, in about another 12 months, half of the fat is back, but the muscle doesn't come back. And so that's absolutely the key point to pass on.
And just for US listeners who might not have top of mind, a kilo is 2.2 pounds. It's really substantial. It's a huge loss.
Yeah, you're talking
loss.
25 pounds of fat loss and 15 pounds of muscle mass loss in that short time. So it's great because you reduce your fat. And of course, that has implications for energy metabolism and cardiovascular health. It's great for cardiovascular health. But you have to also think that you're having this side impact in a detrimental way on your muscle health. And
incredibly detrimental.
To a certain extent. So,
I mean, how do you characterize the fallout of that much muscle loss in such a short period of time? I mean, how do we even think about it? I mean, muscle is such a metabolically active organ. I mean, it, you know, it provides us energy, it provides us stability, it, you know, it helps clear the body of, you know, excess glucose, et cetera. I mean, all that it does, it's so bioactive. When you lose that much of a muscle, I mean, what is the fallout?
Yeah, the fallout would be, you know, if you're a young individual, perhaps it's not as big an impact because, you know, you still have a substantial amount of reservoir of muscle mass. And if you're in your 40s, 50s, or even an older adult who is overweight and on these, the fallout for me as somebody who studied something we call sarcopenia, which is basically muscle failure with aging, right? It is that you're going to have 3 to 5 times accelerated aging on your muscle. And muscle is such a key longevity organ that, you're going to have a lot of falls in older people. You're going to have a lot of people struggling to cross the zebra line in 15, 20 seconds because they can't, if they fall, you know, the muscle. So I think, yeah, people are not thinking in that direction. And I think that's where nutrition and diet and exercise become such a key companion for these weight loss drugs in parallel.
Right. Yeah. So sarcopenia is like, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's sort of an inflammatory, it's a inflammation driven muscle loss. So it's not just you're losing muscle because you're sedentary. There's sort of an active breakdown due to inflammation. Is that correct?
That is correct. So sarcopenia, like most chronic disorders of aging, is a multi-pronged, multi-factor-driven condition, right? So you have the gradual decline in muscle mass, but what is on top is the quality and the strength is also going down. And that is linked, as you were saying, appropriately to muscle inflammation. So your whole body is inflamed as you're aging. And so that's what these drugs are not really taking care of, is they're not addressing the root cause. They're just taking away the pain of being overweight and obese. So yeah, that's what we want to highlight, is that you want to talk about cellular health, you want to talk about muscle health with aging, and you want to also keep this in mind as you take these weight loss drugs, that using high protein, increasing high protein in your diet, doing exercise, talking to a dietitian and nutritionist, and in parallel, having, you know, thinking about your muscle quality and your mitochondrial health, which is absolutely key with, you know, other nutrients like the ones we have been working on.
It's extraordinary. It almost reminds me a little bit of the potential, you know, we saw the follow-up with gastric bypass, you know, the malnourishment that happened, just pretty tragic fallout. I had a number of patients that I worked with who were, you know, really had evidence of, in some cases, relatively profound malnourishment because they were just weren't guided on the nutrients they needed to focus on with that, you know, very radical procedure. And I think you're just underscoring how powerful the potential problem is, you know, for these GLP-1s, which are, I mean, I think they're really people need to adhere to them really for life, or at least for a very sustained amount of time.
Yeah, these are great drugs, as I mentioned. I think these are great drugs, and the health economic impact of lowering obesity, and which as a result will have cardiovascular health improvement implications, is immense.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, trying to cure one thing, you don't want to create another problem.
Very difficult problem.
I get reminded all the time with statins. So, you know, there's a lot of craze with statins, and of course they're great lowering cholesterol, but in 20% folks, you started seeing muscle and mitochondrial issues. So yeah, it's very similar.
So obviously, so first of all, anybody prescribing these drugs or anybody taking them needs to heed, you know, the inevitable muscle loss. They need to actually really fight that concurrent loss with, as you pointed out, using protein, continuing to engage or starting to engage in, you know, active resistance training. I don't know, maybe the drug is even contraindicated in older people who aren't going to undergo those two interventions. Maybe it would be, but, and I want your thought on that, but obviously, you know, we need to talk about urolithin A and what you guys have found, you know, and mechanistically how it would be an important piece of supporting those using GLP-1 agonists.
I mean, the message I would say is really about muscle preservation there, right? So yeah, if you preserve your muscle in the journey of losing fat mass, then you have a winning combination, right? So if you can proactively think about how to keep your muscle quality and muscle mass, obviously with high protein, but then think about muscle quality with sort of the products that we have in the targeting mitochondrial health and muscle quality, that should be part of sort of the nutrition companion that I was talking about, that clinicians need to be aware that when they're embarking their patients on a journey of reduced weight loss with these weight loss drugs, that they also think in the future, you know, or in parallel what they can do with these companion products that Timeline has or other companies have on the protein side.
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about the evidence around muscle preservation, muscle actually beyond preservation. I think that you've demonstrated at least increased, and the mechanism, I think there's some suggestion, and you'll correct me or tease it out a little bit, is that it's going really directly after that inflammation driven, you know, sarcopenic.
So we have studied this for the last 10 plus years. Muscle is a longevity organ. You take a look at 70-year-olds who are active, training for 10-kilometer races or cycling regularly, and you look at 70-year-olds who are overweight and sedentary, and it's really black and white in terms of what we call mitochondria health in their skeletal muscles, right? So more mitochondria in the active people, very poor quality mitochondria in great sedentary folks. And so if you take those folks and then you put them on this postbiotic product that we have identified called MitoPure, which is basically urolithin A, which is sort of a derivative from polyphenols present in our diet, what you see is that you kind of keep the mitochondria, you boost the mitochondrial health in the skeletal muscle, and you not only keep the muscle mass and the muscle strength, but you actually gain in muscle quality and mitochondrial quality, and that translates to better force, muscle force, and muscle being less fatigued in the long term.
What have you shown in your clinical trials around this?
So we have never combined it with these weight loss drugs, for example.
Right.
But what we have done in older adults, so 70-year-olds or 50-year-olds who are not obese but overweight, so on the journey to being obese, we have shown that in 2 to 4 months of regular intake, without changing activity levels, physical activity levels, without changing diet, we have seen in about 2 months improved endurance in the muscle, meaning the muscle has more energy to keep doing a certain task. And in 4 months, we have seen in both these populations an increase in muscle strength by about 10%.
And this is without an exercise prescription, correct? They're not doing anything. You haven't prescribed anything.
Yeah, we haven't prescribed anything. They're not talking to a dietitian or to change their diet.
They're not training.
They're not training. But the other thing we see, back to your inflammation question, is whether it's the older adults or the overweight 50-year-olds, they're all inflamed. Their C-reactive protein, which is a marker of inflammation, is off the roof. And that gets dampened. So there's a very close crosstalk between mitochondria and the immune system. And we are actually exploring this, how we get this dual effect on dampening the inflammation and boosting muscle and mitochondrial health. We have done a trial very recently looking in athletes, actually, who also get inflamed with regular training.
Yes.
In a training program, we have given it MitoPure with exercise and compared it to exercise alone. And we see better recovery. We see, again, less inflammation and less exertion. So it works even if you give exercise. And that's my thinking today, is that in this sort of obese population that is on the weight loss, they are definitely inflamed. We know that. Their mitochondria are not in good shape, right? And so what makes sense to do nutritionally, in addition to, of course, exercise and high protein diet, is to take products like Timelines, MitoPure, because you're going to hit on both these things that, you know, the biology is gone a bit awry in these folks.
It's so extraordinary to me. I always love to talk to you and hear what you're up to and your commitment to the science and evolving it, and just really drilling down into what's happening. But it's this continuum where urolithin A is efficacious. So you are sarcopenic and obese, you know, and you can take it as a standalone intervention, and it can reduce that inflammatory driven sarcopenia and increase muscle mass without moving. There's no exercise prescription in those studies. I mean, that's crazy. You know, it's just now you've shown this improvement because you're going right to the mechanism of breakdown, which is, I think, this inflammatory phenomena and the poor mitochondrial quality. But then the continuum is you're using them in these elite athletes who are, arguably overtraining and driving inflammation from the other side and damaging mitochondria, you know, from the sort of the equal and opposite mechanism, and, mm-hmm. and showing benefit in recovery and exercise tolerance and all of those things as well. So it's just this continuum here, which I think is interesting and cool, and it's important. You know, again, it's been just this, so this conversation, you know, I'm thinking of my mom who pushes back on doing resistance training. She's in great shape. She's very healthy at 83. But she likes to stretch. That's her thing. And she argues with me that stretching is the most important, not, you know, weightlifting, but, you know, she needs to be on it, but really, I mean, it's important for all of us. And going back to points you and I have talked about before, we used to, probably most of us used to make this. We evolved with the information from Urolithin A sort of driving mitochondrial health. But you and I have talked about the fact, and that's, I mean, and so that's why mechanistically we all probably need to be, we need to be taking Urolithin A if we're not making it. And we can test that through you. Because we evolved with this kind of really important information, but now we've lost it. You know, we don't make it efficiently. We don't have this, and we see the fallout, but I think that's why, it must be why, you know, it has such far-reaching effects.
And it's just not our research, Kara. I think there's a study, maybe we talked about in the past, but there's a Spanish group that has, you know, we've discovered the benefits and the direct effects on the mitochondria of this molecule. But they were more interested in the gut microbiome evolution and overweight people and how, you know, the certain number of percentage of people have the right gut microbiome to make this postbiotic molecule, Urolithin A, and 60, 70% of the folks don't have it. And then they even looked in the overweight of these individuals, and they found, obviously, the gut microbiome is very different in these individuals. But they found that the ones making it, even if you were overweight, they had better muscle quality, and they had more resistance to develop cardiovascular incidences and diseases compared to those who couldn't naturally make Urolithin A. So this is a publication that doesn't get talked about and highlighted because it came from a small academic research group out of Spain. But I think it's a very important piece of the puzzle that, as you were saying, that we all had this evolutionary, a lot of us have lost the capability. And who knows, again, you know, back to the conversation on these GLP-1 drugs, who knows what the effect these are having on the gut microbiome. And we know there's a gut muscle axis as well, and there's a gut skin axis as well. So I think only 5 to 10 years down the road, we will get more data and more research being done. Right now, it's a buzzword. But it's just to remind listeners, and that... Yeah, think about your muscle, think about your muscle quality and mitochondrial health.
Yeah, it seems like it's absolutely indicated to those of us supporting individuals on the GLP-1 agonists or those of us prescribing them. We do want to be thinking about the muscle fallout. And just as I was preparing for our conversation today, I was thinking about how we make GLP-1 in the L cells, in the gut, you know, and we make them at the behest of Acromantia, Clostridium butyricum, probably other players, but those two have been characterized. You know, we make GLP-1 at the direction of a healthy microbiome. And so it occurred to me, you know, we know that Urolithin A, there's evidence out there in animals and humans that Urolithin A itself can stimulate production of some of these bugs that produce GLP-1. It makes me wonder, and, you know, going back to the evolutionary conversation, you know, why are there so many of us who are obese now? You know, we have this damaged microbiome. Many of us are likely not even producing, we're not able to sustain, you know, adequate synthesis of GLP-1, you know, and so therefore we're not adequately satiated and we continue to eat. But Urolithin A may be influencing GLP from this direction as well. I just think that would be kind of a fun study to look at.
It would be, and we haven't done that yet, but we have looked at what changes happen in the the gut microbiome of people, just like you were mentioning, that are, as I say, blessed to make this molecule. And you're right, absolutely spot on. They have more Ackermansia, they have more, you know, these diverse and healthy bugs in our GI tract. So research needs to be done. What we have looked, and we are looking, and there are preclinical studies with urolithinase, is looking at glucose metabolism, the effect on, if you did a glucose tolerance test in a high fat fed animal, for example, what would be the effect of urolithinase? And we, not one, but there are several studies from different groups in the US and Europe showing that urolithinase preserved muscle mass had sort of an effect on the fat inflammation by dampening the inflammation, and led to lower glucose effects. And is that through GLP-1 or through other sort of pathways that you were mentioning, through the gut microbiome? Are there other ways to hit on glucose metabolism? Needs to be studied. And we have actually now running one of the largest trials on urolithinase with the National Institute of Aging, a lady called Josephine Egan, who actually discovered GLP-1 back in the 80s and 90s. So
very interesting.
Very curious, and we are doing this study in pre-diabetic, overweight individuals, try to see how, and we look at all these hormones and GLP-1 in that study.
Oh, that's very interesting. Are you guys still recruiting, or is it underway? When
yeah,
will you have results?
It's on clinicaltrials.gov, and it's recruiting in the National Institute of Health. Baltimore, Maryland area. If you're interested, sign up for it if you fit the inclusion exclusion criteria.
We'll make sure that, you know, my team connects with your team, and we'll get all these links in the show notes, everybody. Sure. If you go over to the website, you can find all of this information. We'll also link to a nice hefty bibliography of these extraordinary studies. People are researching urolithinase for all sorts of indications. I mean, it's just a hotbed of science happening, you know, thanks to you guys characterizing this molecule and kind of moving it out into the world and, you know, bringing attention to it. It's very exciting. It's potently pleiotropic. You know, there's more to be discovered. It's very exciting, and I'll continue to, you know, hopefully host you guys here and talk about it. I have one more question. It's a little bit of an outlier question, but it's just around excessive weight loss in the face. So you got the dermatological. I mean, that's a huge problem, or at least it's a discomfort. You know, when people lose a lot of weight and they actually look old. And I mean, is there any kind of, and I mean, I have patients in my practice struggling with that, and we're dialoguing with how to deal with it. And I think at this point, our best recommendation is filler, unfortunately. But what do you guys think about with regard to this problem?
Yeah, so there are, I mean, as you said, this is a concern, actually highlighted by one of the dermatologists at NYU, and then a lot of people have woken up to this, that those who have been on Ozempic or Ozempic-like weight loss drugs over a period of time, they have this Ozempic face. I think that's what you were describing, which is basically what they describe as sort of accelerated skin aging. Kind of, you have wrinkles, you have a loss of skin elasticity, you lose the fat, obviously, just not in the, you know, the like abdominal fat, but you're losing fat in the face. And so that gives you like a shrunk and hollow look on the face. So, and you're right, the option that I hear dermatologists is fillers, but I think what you need to think is the timeline has just not nutrition targeted products towards improving muscle and mitochondrial health. We have also, you know, we are a longevity company, and we try to deepen the science on mitochondria, whether it's muscle, brain, or skin. And so we actually started hearing from our oral consumers that they were seeing skin effects. And so we developed this, we studied the skin and its mitochondria, and we found that we could take old, poorly energetic mitochondria and skin cells of old people in their skin cells, and we could turn them much like we saw in the muscle cells. And so we ran these studies, and we see improvement in skin hydration, better behavior, less wrinkles, less, you know, better elasticity. And so it is one of the options I think people have. Again, back to link it to the Ozempic story, I think losing fat in a very fast manner has ramifications, and so you don't want accelerated aging happening in your muscle or your skin, you know. And so we have a line of products that people can look up, listeners can look up timeline.com mm-hmm. and see our suite of skincare products that really hit on skin longevity and skin health.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it is coming at it from a similar angle. It's inhibiting the inflammation, supporting collagen regeneration.
Yeah, it's hitting intrinsic, extrinsic aging, which is basically skin inflammation and poor mitochondrial cellular health. And we know MitoPure does amazing things on both those pathways. And, mm-hmm. and we have great data that we have published in a preprint, and now we're trying to get it published in the top journal as well. It's finding a suite of randomized trials.
Good. Okay. Well, we'll definitely link to that preprint as well, and you know, tag it when it's accepted into a journal. All right. Well, Dr. Singh, once again, it was just really great to talk to you. Anything to add? Anything we didn't cover?
I think we covered mostly. You know, I probably just, you know, people who are on these journey of these weight loss drugs need to have it. Discussion with a doctor, talk to the dietitian. Yes. I think that should be standard practice in the clinical realm. Is what are the other options available to think 360, right? Just not the eye on the prize, which at that moment seems to be increased weight loss in 12, 18 months, but think the long-term ramification and keep that muscle is a very key longevity organ.
Yes.
You need to pay attention to it.
Yes, and we're losing a significant amount. Those numbers are daunting.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, again, always appreciate you joining
me. Yeah, pleasure.
Always fun and
very, you know, always great discussions with you, Kara. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.